Tonight is November 21st, Monday night at Sheret Israel. We're learning Parshat Toldot. And although we'll spend tonight about a third of the class on the Parsha itself, the verses and the story in the Parsha really will only be a jumping off point for a moral and legal discussion on the subject, do the ends ever justify the means, which is a very, very ancient, famous, and difficult philosophic and moral issue. Do the ends ever justify the means? And the foundation, the jumping off point for that discussion, this week's Parsha, is of course the story of the deception and theft. So what happens, to make a long story short, as we'll see the verses, but just an introduction, we know that Yaakov is actually the youngest son, at least by a few seconds, of his parents. And therefore, he's not the firstborn. The firstborn traditionally gets the bracha, gets the blessings, and he will lead the family in future generations. And it looks from the verses that Yaakov himself knows, and his mother knows, that he is the one that is fitting to lead the Jewish people. But his brother Esav is the firstborn. And he and his mother utilize deception, actually thievery, to wrest the bracha, wrest the blessing from Esav. When I say deception, they have to deceive Father Isaac, Father Yitzchak, and prevent him from giving the bracha to Esav rather to Yaakov, because Yaakov impersonates his brother. And it's not only that, but it's theft, because it's taking away the bracha from Esav, who at least formally deserves it. So that's the story. I want to point out, before we begin reading it briefly, that there are two assumptions that we have to assume in order to understand the story from an internal sense. You might not like these assumptions, you might not agree with them on a personal level, but to understand the story, they're necessary. One assumption, so it seems, is that the formal blessing is important, it's crucial. Whoever gets the blessing, the words, whoever has the words spoken over him by Father, that means something. There's some efficacy, there's some power in those words. And therefore, it's very important, who does Father bless? That's number one. Number two, there seems to be an assumption in the story that Yaakov and Esav are not just Yaakov and Esav. They are standing in, they're representing future generations. In other words, there's a sense there, a sense with Rivka, a sense with Isaac, a sense with Jacob, Yaakov, that there's something at stake here. That God gave the blessing of founding this people to Abraham, and Abraham passed it on to Isaac, and the person who gets it from Isaac, he will be a patriarch of the Jewish people. They might not know they'll be called the Jewish people, but they have a sense of destiny riding on their shoulders. And therefore, the question of how to act is not just a question like between me and you. It's a question like between Winston Churchill and Roosevelt. It's a big question that the future of the world is hanging upon. And they have to do the best thing. So let's start reading the story. We're in, of course, Bereishit, Genesis chapter 25, as the source sheet says, looking at verse 21. So it's Genesis 25:21. And we're looking at the bare bones story without too much embellishment here. 25:21. So the first verse we're looking at, in my English-only edition, it's page 38, but many of you have, of course, different editions. Again, Genesis 25:21, and we'll read the last part of verse 21, and his wife, Rebekah, that's Rivka, conceived, the wife of Yitzchak Isaac. But the children struggled in her womb, there were two of them, twins, and she said, if so, why do I exist? She went to inquire of the Lord, and the Lord answered her, and I emphasize her, two nations are in your womb, two separate people shall issue from your body, one people shall be mightier than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. So she had this prophecy that the younger is to have ascendancy. But the prophecy was to her, and we wonder if she told anyone else. That is to say, we wonder if she told her husband. When her time to give birth was at hand, there were twins in her womb. The first one emerged red like a hairy mantle all over, so they named him Esav. Then his brother emerged holding on the heel of Esav. So they named him Yaakov, which means the healer. He takes hold of the heel. Now, I think it's important, it's extremely important, that Esav was hairy and the hair was red, because hair seems to represent animalistic nature and red represents blood or violence. In other words, what we heard in the prophecy that the older shall serve the younger, that the older is not to be the leader, that's also expressed in a physical sense, that the older is a bit animal-like, and therefore we understand that it's the younger that is meant to lead. And then the verses go on. When the boys grew up, Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the outdoors, but Jacob was an ishtam. The English says a mild man. Ishtam, that's the same word used for Noah, that he was a perfectly righteous person. Tam meaning perfect. It also says in the book of Job that he was Tam v'yashar. He was perfect and upright. It was, the simple meaning seems to be that he was a good guy. He was perfect. He was up there with the best, and compared to his brother was a man of the outdoors. That's not a bad thing, but it's not to be someone who is a leader of the Jewish people. Okay. Now, I understand I'm reading a lot into this, and we could discuss all this, but I want to get someplace else tonight. So I'm just giving you the background as understood by the vast, vast, vast majority of commentators in all the ages. And then we go on to chapter 26, verse 34. 26:34. And again, as usual, all the sources we're looking at are in the sheet that I prepared. 26:34. Very end of chapter 26. When Esav was 40 years old, he took to wife Yehudit, daughter of Be'eri the Hittite, and Bosmat, daughter of Elon the Hittite, and they were a source of bitterness to Isaac and Rebekah. As he married of the Canaanite women, the Hittites are Canaanites, and that's a no-no for the children of Avraham and Yitzhak. And again, you see that Esav is not cut out to be, and he's not acting like a future leader of the chosen people of God. And then we go on to chapter 27, the first 19 verses. When Isaac was old and his eyes were too dim to see, he called his older son Esav and said to him, "My son." And he answered, "Here I am." And he said, "I am old now and I do not know how soon I may die. Take your gear, your quiver and bow, and go out into the open and hunt me some game. Then prepare a dish for me such as I like and bring it to me to eat so that I may give you my innermost blessing before I die." Rebekah had been listening as Isaac spoke to his son Esav. So we have here Rebekah the mother. When Esav had gone out into the open to hunt game to bring home, Rebekah, Rivka, said to her son Yaakov, "I overheard your father speaking to your brother Esav, saying, 'Bring me some game and prepare a dish for me to eat that I may bless you with the Lord's approval before I die. Now, my son, listen carefully as I instruct you. Go to the flock and fetch me two choice kids, and I will make of them a dish for your father such as he likes. Then take it to your father to eat in order that he may bless you before he dies." Yaakov answered his mother, Rivka, "But my brother Esav is a hairy man, and I am smooth-skinned. If my father touches me, I shall appear to him as a trickster and bring upon myself a curse, not a blessing." But his mother said to him, "Your curse, my son, be upon me. Just do as I say and go fetch them from me." He got them and brought them to his mother, and his mother prepared a dish such as his father liked. Rivka then took the best clothes of her older son Esav, which were there in the house, and had her younger son Yaakov put them on. And she covered his hands and the hairless part of his neck with the skins of the kids. Then she put in the hands of her son Jacob the dish and the bread that she had prepared. He went to his father and said, "Father." And he said, "Yes, which of my sons are you?" Yaakov said to his father, "I am Esav, your firstborn. I have done as you told me. Pray, sit up and eat of my game that you may give me your innermost blessing." And the story goes on that indeed he, through his lying, deceives his father and gets the blessing that his father intended for his older brother. And here we have it in the Torah. We have the utilization of lying, of deception, of thievery, clearly for what the characters, Rivka and Yaakov, believe to be a noble purpose. And the question is, do the means justify, does the end justify the means? In Judaism, I would say that this is the center of that question. It's a question that is discussed again and again in so many different contexts. Well, what do you think? In the story, what do you think? In other words,
in the story, it seems the end justifies the means.
In what sense?
In that because Jacob was probably the better leader of the Jewish people than Esau.
Yeah.
And the fact that it was a prophecy, do we have to give credibility to that? And if so, if that was somehow direct or indirectly from God's words, then...
Yes, what we can still ask, does prophecy justify lying and deception?
Is it prophecy manipulation?
Say it again, please.
Is it prophecy manipulation?
You said or manipulation? And she had the prophecy, and she uses manipulation to make sure it comes true. But we could ask the question, are you supposed to manipulate, lie, steal in order to assure prophecy's fulfillment?
Well, who's to say that the ends are justified?
Well, that's what we're asking.
But you're saying, do the means justify the end?
No. Does the end
justify
the means?
So, she thought that this was a prophecy, and therefore, however I can get there to get my younger son to fulfill the prophecy. But
that's what she thought, absolutely.
Someone has to judge whether true. Or maybe they would have occurred without this deception.
Indeed. That's part of what goes into the equation.
Well, I want to slightly escalate your question to this is the ends justifying the means with regard to a nation or a people as opposed to an individual. And I think that's a big issue. I mean, when Obama sends a drone out to kill a guy in the desert, we don't consider it murder. We consider it self-defense of America.
Right.
So, you know, when God tells the Israel people to slaughter someone and take the land, it's not a Cain and Abel story. It's a people story. So,
very
in this
point.
Case, isn't this sort of more of a the birthright of nationalities or countries to, you know, act in their own self-interest as opposed to like a Cain and Abel story, so to speak?
It's a good point. Is a country permitted to lie and deceive in peace negotiations? Right?
And at the time that this happened, were the people elevated to the level of community, or was it still individual? We talked a lot about this in past lessons on the transition from doing things for oneself to doing things at the community level.
The way we had talked about it, it was from the other side, right, that the sense of individuality is actually what developed later. Right?
Well,
if I remember correctly,
thought we argued the point on which was more important, but I can't remember where it started.
we had talked about the sense of larger collective identity, a family clan actually preceding the development of the sense of individuality. And here, indeed, like we do seem to have a sense of representing a larger group in these biblical characters. They have a sense of destiny, I think.
I don't really feel the need to judge it right or wrong. It's kind of like the Noah story. You know, he was said to be a righteous man in his time, and I feel like Jacob and Rebecca are human beings, and that a little further on down the road with Laban, I mean, Jacob kind of gets a taste of his own medicine. So I feel like it's a story, you know, that he doesn't have to be right or wrong at this point.
Okay, but the matter of a taste of your own medicine, we wonder if that's a biblical cue that's rendering a value judgment. And that actually is what we wanted to talk about next. But first, Naftali.
The question, I guess, that I would ask is, there's a collaboration here. Jacob doesn't ask about the seed.
Yeah.
This is not right. He's actually participating in this. Maybe he will, he's not asking, is this right or wrong? Has this left a stigma on us as a people?
Oh, that's a good question.
Deceit and skimming is almost part of our heritage. It's awful to say, and I guess it's just small. But we see it. We see it with the brothers later on.
Okay.
I mean, it just occurs all the time and over, and you wonder. You know, even what does it teach us as a lesson?
Good stuff here. Good stuff. Yeah, so we have all that is planned to open up here. I thought it might be a good idea just to put on the table some different examples of what we're talking about. So I put this in B. Everyone, I'm sure, has 10 or 20 or 30 other examples. For a man, at least, this is, of course, written from a male point of view, these sheets. I'm not talking about the Tanakh. I'm talking about these sheets here. lying concerning your wife's new dress, right? And she asks the men of the house, how do you like my new dress? What are you supposed to say? Right? If you tell the truth, who knows what might happen?
We know.
You know, for experience, what might happen?
Yeah.
Here we have an honest man in the room. Or if you receive the gift, right, from someone, they ask you, how do you like my gift? Well, what do you say? Lying to save human life, right? Stealing medicine to alleviate suffering. Not even for human life, just to alleviate suffering. Is it the right thing to do? And murdering one to save many. For example, think of a doctor who has on the operating table someone who's about to die. But if he takes the organs out 5 minutes earlier, he can save five people with the liver and with the kidneys and with the heart and with the lungs. Should he, as it were, murder to save five? Important questions. Just to put it in a philosophical context, there are those who distinguish in this discussion between consequentialist ethics and deontological ethics. And this reminds me of my college days. But to make a long story short, consequential ethics is easy to understand. That you judge the rightness or the wrongness of the deed on the basis of the result. If it achieves good results, of course that has to be defined, but if it achieves good results, then it's proper, the act is good. So in our question, do the ends justify the means? If we assume, as it looks like we should, that the ends are important and are good, and this is the only way to achieve them, then a consequentialist would say, of course the ends justify the means. A deontological approach is an approach of rules. It's not the consequences, it's examining the act in and of itself and seeing if it conforms to the rules of rightness or wrongness. And there are different systems that have different rules. In this context, I remember from a long, long time ago, and so I really can't sign on dotted line that this is true what I'm about to say, but I seem to remember in my days of studying philosophy that we were told, I didn't see this inside, that Immanuel Kant said the following, that if you are harboring in your home someone who is being pursued by a murderer, and you have the person in your home, they're hidden in the closet, and the murderer comes to the door and his gun is pointed at you. Of course, 300 years ago, 250 years, it was a sword and not a gun. And the murderer says, are the people I'm looking for in your house? And Kant says, you have to tell the truth. It's forbidden to lie.
Why?
So again, I don't want to go into the base of Kantian ethics of the can't even get the words out of my mouth, but everything I learned 25 years ago and 30 years ago about Kantian ethics. But I just want to say that there is such a position, right? There is such a position. And if we say that lying is categorically wrong. That's it, the categorical imperative, right? If it's categorically wrong, then you can't lie. So those are some of the questions involved here. Now, what's fascinating is that it's not hard to make a case to claim that the book of Genesis actually does make a value judgment vis-a-vis this act of Jacob and Rivka. If we read on, and I'm going to bring here about 10, 11 different sources in the book of Genesis, there might just be a clear and absolute value judgment. And what I'm about to say comes from Professor Nachum Sarna, who taught for most of his career Bible at Brandeis. And he was one of the major Jewish Bible commentators of the 20th century. When he retired, for health reasons, he moved to Boca Raton, Florida. And in 1998, I came there with my family, spent 2 years. I got to know him very well. And actually, we're going to study right now. He not only did he write about it, actually he told me this personally when I once asked him. I just have to tell a story about him. He was an amazing scholar, but also a wonderful person. There was, for some reason, a custom in the Boca Raton Synagogue that every Shabbat afternoon, just about everyone would come to hear the rabbi's class. What a wonderful custom. We don't have it here in Dallas. Like, literally, there were 80 to 100 people in the room every Shabbat afternoon, at least during the summers when the Shabbatot were longer. And the senior rabbi, Rabbi Kenneth Brander, would very often give the class. But I would always pester him, let me give the class, I like to give the class. And by the end of my time there, I was always giving this class. Professor Sarna would come with his wife to every class of mine. Now he knew everything I would say, of course he knew everything. And he just sat there with a smile on his face and listened to all the nonsense I would say. And he never corrected me. It was unbelievable. It was unbelievable. So anyway, what I'm about to say, I hope it's not nonsense because it comes from him. So let's just look at these sources, the aftermath of this act of deception for the family, and then indeed, the aftermath of this act of deception for Yaakov himself. So we're in chapter 27, verse 32. And it says in verse 32 of chapter 27 the following. And this is after Yaakov deceived his father and got the bracha meant for his brother. His father Isaac said to him, "Who are you?" And this is when Esav has come into the room back with the venison from the hunt. And he said, "I'm your son Esav, your firstborn." Isaac was seized with a very violent trembling. "Who was it then?" he demanded, "that hunted game and brought it to me." Why'd I read that? Isaac was scarred, deeply hurt by the fact that his son lied to him, trembled with a great trembling. And then look at the same chapter, verses 34, and then 35, and then 38. What happened to Esav? So in 34, when Esav heard his father's words, he burst into wild and bitter sobbing. And he said to his father, "Bless me too, father." But he answered, "Your brother came with guile and took away your blessing." And then verse 38, and Esav said to his father, "Have you but one blessing, father? Bless me too, father." And Esav wept aloud. So what I'm trying to say is that this act of deception hurt at least two people. It hurt Isaac, Yitzchak, and it hurt Esav terribly. But the big question, what effect did it have on Yaakov? Deception, what effect did it have on the deceiver? And now we have all these verses to look at, which develop an amazingly complicated tapestry. So look at 27:41, the same chapter we're in now, verse 41.
Can you explain the difference between birthright and blessing?
No, absolutely not.
No?
No. It's a completely different subject, and I might not succeed.
All right.
It's another way of saying I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know enough to say anything intelligent.
Alright.
Now Esav harbored a grudge against Jacob because of the blessing which his father had given him, and Esav said to himself, "Let but the mourning period of my father come, and I will kill my brother Jacob." When the words of her older son Esav reported to Rebekah, she sent for her younger son Yaakov and said to him, "Your brother Esav is consoling himself by planning to kill you. Now, my son, listen to me. Flee at once to Haran, to my brother Laban." Okay, so he goes into exile because he's being pursued by his brother. Next set of verses, 29:21, and this is what Rhonda mentioned a few minutes ago. 29:21, Jacob has gone to his mother's brother's house in Haran in Mesopotamia, and he's fallen in love with Rachel, the younger daughter, and he's worked 7 years to get her hand in marriage. And then in verse 21, then Yaakov said to his father-in-law, his future father-in-law, the father of his future wife, Rachel, give me my wife, for my time is fulfilled, that I may cohabit with her. And Laban gathered all the people to the place and made a feast. When evening came, he took his daughter Leah and brought her to him, and he cohabited with her. Laban had given his maidservant Zilpah to his daughter Leah as a maid. When morning came, there was Leah. So he said to Laban, "What is this you have done to me? I was in your service for Rachel. Why did you deceive me?" Laban said, "Is not the practice in our place to marry off the younger before the older?" Shades of his own deed. His own medicine has come back to haunt him, and that's what the rabbis called measure for measure. And it can't be a coincidence. Now, clearly, the Tanakh is telling us that he's suffering for the evil that he did. And there's lots more like this. So we go to the next set of verses, 31:6. We're just going to rattle them off right now. 31:6. Yaakov says to his two wives, Rachel and Leah, "As you know, I have served your father with all my might, but your father has cheated me, changing my wages time and again." The cheater finds himself being cheated. And then another set of verses, we're going to 31:22. So Yaakov at one point leaves his father-in-law with his entourage, his two wives, who are four wives, and all his children, and he flees from his father-in-law. On the third day, Laban was told that Jacob had fled. So he took his kinsmen with him and pursued him a distance of 7 days, catching up with them in the hill country of Gilad. So Yaakov is fleeing for his life, and he's being pursued. His life is not easy at all. So this might not be measure for measure, but I'm just showing that he has a difficult life from this point on. Another set of verses. 31:31. And this is when Laban catches up with him and confronts him. 31:31. Yaakov answered Laban, saying, "I was afraid because I thought you would take your daughters from me by force. That's why I fled. But anyone with whom you find your God shall not remain alive. In your presence of our kinsmen, point out what I have taken of yours and take it." Yaakov, of course, did not know that Rachel had stolen them. So you don't have all the background. Rachel had stolen her father's gods. And then Laban confronts him and said, "Why did you steal them?" Yaakov says, "I didn't steal anything. Whoever took them shall die." And Jacob didn't know that Rachel had stolen. In other words, he was deceived by his wife. The deceiver, yeah. Deceiver has been deceived again by Laban and by his wife. Now we get to 32:7. 32:7 is the Torah portion of Vayishlach. In 32:7, the whole story you know, Jacob is back in the land of Israel with all his entourage. 32:7, the messengers return to Jacob saying, "We have come to your brother Esav, he himself is coming to meet you, and there are 400 men with him." Jacob was greatly frightened in his anxiety, divided the camp with him and the flocks and the herds and the camps of two camps, thinking, "If Esav come to the one camp and attacks it, the other camp may yet escape." He's been over 20 years away. But when he comes back, he finds his brother approaching with 400 armed men, and he is petrified. Again, this might not be measure for measure, but it's certainly a matter of a difficult life that ensues since he did what he did. And of course, what happens here is because of what he did, his brother still hates him, or so it seems. So now we're going to 32:25. That same night he arose, taking his two wives, his two maidservants, 11 children, he crossed the fork of the ford of the Yabok. After taking them across the stream, he sent across his possessions. Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the break of dawn. He's attacked at night. without going into what the symbolism of the whole thing is, he's attacked at night. Again, his life is not easy at all. Some more verses. 34:1. 34:1-2. Now Dinah, the daughter whom Leah had borne to Jacob, went out to visit the daughters of the land. Shechem, son of Hamor, the Hivite chief of the country, saw her and took her and lay her with her by force. His daughter is raped. Not good. Not good for her, not good for him. 35:16. They set out from Beit El, but when they were still some distance short of Ephrat, Rachel was in childbirth and she had hard labor. When her labor was at its hardest, the midwife said to her, "Have no fear, for it is another boy for you." But as she breathed her last, etc., thus Rachel died. She was buried on the road to Ephrat, now Beit Lechem. His wife dies, his beloved wife, at a rather young age. Not easy. But there's more. 37:18. What was that? Yep. Only a 15-minute drive from my house. So we're in 37:18. This is the story of the brothers putting Joseph into a pit and leaving him for dead. They saw him from afar, and before he came close to them, they conspired to kill him. They said to one another, "Here comes that dreamer," etc. So Yaakov has deep dissension within his family. His sons, the majority, want to kill Joseph. That's what he's suffering with, and that's the tension he has in his household. But it gets even worse, because now we go to 37:31, and we get back to the idea of measure for measure. 37:31, so after they put him in the pit and leave him for dead, perhaps they sold him to a caravan, perhaps they didn't, it's not clear. But in 37:31, they come back to father, and they bring with them, let's read it, 31, then they took Joseph's tunic, slaughtered a kid. Reminds us, slaughtering a kid reminds us of the kid that was slaughtered to deceive father, and dipped the tunic in the blood. They had the ornamented tunic taken to their father, and they said, "We found this, please examine it. Is it your son's tunic or not?" He recognized it and said, "My son's tunic, a savage beast devoured him. Joseph was torn by a beast." Jacob rent his clothes, put sackcloth on his loins, and observed mourning for his sons many days. For his son many days. The son who deceived his father, that man is deceived in turn by his sons. Looks like measure for measure. Pretty clear. But that's not the end. Let's end this with 47:9. The end of the life of Jacob. How does he sum up his life? He comes down to Paro as an old man, over 100. And Jacob answered Paro, "The years of my sojourn on earth are 130. Few and hard have been the years of my life. Nor do they come up to the lifespans of my fathers during their sojourns." He says concerning his own life, "I've had a bad time of it." Now we wonder, it might not be because of what he did with his brother and against his father, but it might be. Not clear. And I just want to point out, without reading the verses, that the end of the life of Abraham and at the end of the life of Yitzhak, the verses say that they had a good and full life. At the end of the life of Yaakov, he says, "Few and hard have been the years of my life," and we wonder why. And this might be why, because of what he did. Again, it's not certain, but we did see two matters of clear midah keneged midah, measure for measure. Now, there's two more sets of verses, which, again, were pointed out to me by Professor Sarna. So let's look at Yirmiyahu 9:3. Some of you don't have a full Tanakh. And even if you do, the English here doesn't help too much. But if you read the Hebrew with the English, then something very powerful comes out here. So I'm looking for the book of Yirmiyahu, chapter 9. In my English-only edition, it comes out to page 788. So the prophet is describing the terrible behavior of the people of the end of the First Temple period.
What sentence?
9:3, chapter 9, verse 3. And in English it says, chapter 9, verse 3, "Beware every man of his friend, trust not even a brother. For every brother takes advantage, every friend is base in his dealings." Not related to us, but if you look at the Hebrew, it says, if you have it, look at there, it says, "Kol ach Akov Yaakov," which means every brother, Yaakov's his brother. Mm-hmm. That's translated as every brother takes advantage. But it's Kol ach Akov Yaakov. Everyone's Yaakoving his brother. And at least according to Professor Sarn, it looks like a clear allusion to how Yaakov behaved towards his brother. And there's one more verse like that in Hosea. We don't have to read everything here. Hosea 12, verse 3. So now, you're going to hear something surprising from me. The conclusion of all this might not be, that Yaakov did the wrong thing. Might not be. Now, it's true that Professor Sarna, and he writes about this in a number of places, he is certain from the verses we saw that the Tanakh has an extremely pejorative judgment on the behavior of Yaakov. But the truth is, it's possible to read it differently. And as far as I understand, the majority, the mainstream approach in Jewish tradition has actually been to read it differently. That what Yaakov did was correct and right and moral, but he was punished for it anyway. And that gets us into the messiness of life. That there are things that you might have to do. Good things, important things, crucial things, but you still have to pay the consequences. You have to pay the price. Lying and deception are dangerous, and they affect you. They taint the soul. I'm talking to the person who utilizes them. And there might be places in which you have to lie, and you have to practice deceit and deception, and even cause the terrible pain that he caused to his father and his brother. It might be justified, but that doesn't mean that it's easy. That doesn't mean that there's no effect to it. So these are basically the two approaches we can take. We can't ignore the verses. Certainly he was punished. But does that mean that we should come to the conclusion that, at least in this case, the ends do not justify the means? Professor Sarna's evaluation. And of course, that's going to have implications for our understanding of Jewish life and Jewish law. We will be very, very hesitant to say in any case that the ends justify the means, if it wasn't even so in Yaakov's case, when what he was doing was saving the Jewish people, as it were. We'll be very hesitant. But the other approach, I'm not sure it's any easier. The other approach will say that yes, there might be cases, many cases, in which the ends justify the means. But even if that's so, you might forever be blemished and forever pay the price to the end of your life for doing the right thing.
For the greater good.
For the greater good. Even if did the right thing for the greater good. And, you know, just coming to mind, I don't know why this comes to mind for me. Think of the person who flew the plane that dropped the bomb on Hiroshima. Perhaps he did the right thing. But you think he didn't suffer for it? I mean, mentally. I mean, psychologically.
He committed suicide.
Yeah.
I didn't even know that. Perhaps I knew and I forgot. Right? That's a wonderful example. Remind me about that after class. I'm going to look that up. Right, that's a wonderful example. How many other cases, such similar cases do we know about? People who did the right thing in their lives, but suffered for it. So what we want to do now is just look at sources and try and parse them and see what advice they give us, what guidelines they give us for dealing with this very serious moral conundrum.
Can I just ask you a question?
Of course.
Go back to the beginning. Hashem makes the prophecy, right?
Yes. So what?
Does that trump all?
I mean, how many people hear Hashem? If this is Hashem's will, I mean, obviously, Hashem ordered the birth order.
Not to say there aren't consequences, though, still.
Well, Hashem can see the consequences.
So it might, so there's prophecy that the eldest shall serve the younger, and Yaakov and his mother did what they thought they had to do to make sure that prophecy comes true, and look what happened. And even if it was prophecy, there's a price.
But it could have come about in a different way.
Perhaps.
And they had free will to do...
Perhaps they should have tried something different, right?
They made the wrong choice.
Yeah. Just let me mention a famous case of this type in the Tanakh. And I'm sure everyone's familiar with a little bit of this. King David wanted nothing more in his lifetime to build the Beit HaMikdash, to build the temple. And just when he was ready to do so, God told him, it's in the book of Chronicles, you shall not build the temple because damim rabim shafachta, much blood have you spilt.
What about Moses even? I mean, Moses didn't get to go to the promised land.
Let me finish this case. That doesn't mean that the blood he spilt was unjust. He was the general, the king, who led the Jewish people to war and saved the Jewish people and established the kingdom. No one says that, by and large, those wars were unjust. But despite the fact that they might have been just, you spilled much blood, you can't build my temple. And again, he perhaps did the right thing, but he suffered consequences. Suffered consequences. As far as Moses goes, there are many midrashim that when he broke the tablets, did the right thing, but he suffered consequences. Yeah. So let's look at some sources. So where we want to look now, on the first page that I brought here, it's Midrash Rabbah from our Parsha Toldot. And it says as follows. When Esav heard the words of his father, he cried with an exceeding great and bitter cry. Rabbi Chanina said, whoever maintains that the Holy One, blessed be He, is lax in dispensing justice, may his bowels become lax. He is merely long-suffering, but ultimately collects his due. Jacob made Esav break out into a cry but once. And where was he punished for it? In Shushan the castle, as it says, and he cried with a loud and bitter cry. In other words, it's the same words that Esav cries out with, and that Mordechai, in the story of Purim, cries out with when he hears a decree against the Jewish people. And this Midrash is claiming that the decree of Haman Achashverosh to destroy, to annihilate, to commit genocide against the Jewish people was a direct result of, was a measure for measure punishment for the people of Jacob for what he did in deceiving his father. So Professor Sarna will say, you see, the Midrash says that Jacob was punished, that he did the wrong thing. But most of the commentators will say, no, it's more nuanced than that. He did the right thing, but the Midrash are saying, even for the right thing, there's a price you pay. Here we go. This is a fascinating source we're about to read. Hold on to your chairs. Fascinating, and many say a very dangerous source. Ula said, Ula was a rabbi, I have it on the board, he was from the Amoritic period at the Talmud. It was from 2 weeks ago, I think, last week. Ula said, both Tamar and Zimri committed adultery. Let's remember who they are. Tamar in the book of Genesis, who, according to the laws of that time, after three of her husband's two of her husbands passed away, she was supposed to wait for the third son, the brother of her two husbands, to be given to her in marriage. And she, as it were, is betrothed to that son, waiting for him to grow up. But she arranged things so as to have relationships with someone else, with her father-in-law, actually. That's called adultery here. Zimri, remember, Zimri in chapter 25 of the book of Numbers, he goes a-whoring, he leads the orgy of going a-whoring after the daughters of Moab, which brings great destruction upon the Jewish people. That's right after the incident of Bilam. They both committed adultery. Tamar committed adultery and gave birth to kings and prophets. In other words, what she did was very good. Ultimately, the King David came out of her line. Zimri committed adultery, and on his account, many tens of thousands of Israel perished. So just reading that, you immediately see how the rabbis are telling us that morality is often not black and white. You can't just say that this deed is wrong, period. This deed is wrong, and this deed is right, and they're the same deed. And it's really flaunting it right here in front of us. The same thing could be sometimes wrong and sometimes right. How do you decide? Rabbi Nachman Bar Yitzchak said, a transgression, an avera, performed with good intention, the Hebrew word is lishma, for the right reason, is better than a precept, a mitzvah, performed with an evil intention, which in Hebrew is shelo lishma, for the wrong reason. So look what it just said, that it's better to transgress in a case in which the ends justify the means than it is to do a mitzvah without the proper intention. But has not Rav Yehuda, citing Rav, said, a man should always occupy himself with the Torah and its precepts, even though it will be for some ulterior motive, for the result will be that he will eventually do them without ulterior motive. Now, this is a famous statement that says, you should do mitzvot even shelo lishma, for the wrong reason. Because if you do them, eventually come to do for the right reason. For example, you have a sick child, and you say, I'll give a lot of tzedakah, perhaps God will have mercy. So you're giving tzedakah shelo lishma, for the wrong reason. You're supposed to do it for its own sake, not to get some benefit. Or let's say that you do the mitzvah of being willing to be president of Sheret Israel, but you do it for the wrong reason, because you want the kavod, you want the honor, right? It's for the wrong reason. But it's good to do things even for the wrong reason. Number one, because the right thing gets done, and number two, because you'll eventually come to do it for the right reason. So if we know that doing precepts, doing mitzvot for the wrong reason is okay, is good, actually, then how could you say that doing a transgression for a good intention is better than doing a precept for the wrong reason? Because doing a precept for the wrong reason is good. How could there be something better than it, that it's a transgression? I'm not sure the difficulty that Gemara asks is unanswerable, but that's what it says. So it adjusts itself. And the Gemara says, read then, that a transgression performed with good intention is as good as a precept performed for an ulterior motive. But that's enough for us. In other words, the conclusion is that a transgression performed for a good reason is at least as good as a mitzvah done for the wrong reason. A mitzvah done for the wrong reason is still a mitzvah. It's still good. It's still positive. And also transgression done for a good reason is good. So clearly the Talmud says that at least in some cases the ends justify the means. If there's a good intention, lishma, for the right reason, there might be cases in which transgressions, avirot, sins, crimes are actually laudable. And one example here is adultery. There's going to be a case in which adultery is the right thing, using Tamar as an example.
I have a problem with the basis of, I mean, the stories are not... You can't put them on the same scale.
The story of Tamar and the story of Zimri.
Zimri, yeah.
You're right, but they're both matters of sexuality which might be considered wrong. But one had the right intention, a positive, good intention, and it did, and the other was just for lust.
Yeah,
That's the
connection. She was going to give birth to kings.
No, but it had the right reason. It's complicated, but to make a long story short, it looks like the law in those days were that she has to marry either her husband's brother or her father-in-law. And neither were given to her, so she forced her father-in-law to have relations with her by setting herself up as a prostitute and propositioning him. She did do the right thing.
But did he do the right thing by going with a prostitute?
No, he didn't.
Okay, just making sure.
Right?
So he's just totally wrong.
We're not talking about him. We're talking about her.
What you would think of it is she made a head, or she transgressed, and she caused another person to transgress. So you see, it's
you're right. It's complicated. Yehuda transgressed, but also committed a mitzvah. He thought he was doing a avera, but he's really doing a mitzvah because he was supposed to marry her, and she made him do it, but he didn't know he was doing it.
Aren't we on a slippery slope here because you have society's laws, you have the laws, and you're almost saying that individuals can then, with their own justification, flaunt laws? And
right,
if you do one, maybe one person, it's justified, but if you look at it in a bigger picture, you're almost creating, I don't know, vigilantes, for instance, and all sorts of things you're opening up that are...
Yeah,
you know, and then you're doing away with the legal systems to someone.
That's what I was hinting to earlier when I talked about the messiness of life. A absolute system of morality or of law that says this is wrong and this is right, and you always do what's wrong, you never do, you always do what is right, you never do what is wrong. I caught myself, right? There's a halakhic principle that if you catch yourself within the time that you can say Shalom Alecha Rabbi, is as if you didn't say it. So, okay, right? Had a hair's breadth of time left. So, a system of absolutes is clearly easier to maneuver. And if you say that the ends never justify the means, and you always have to do the right thing, and the right thing is judged according to a law book, let's say in the... Go back to Kant, or you're not allowed to lie, you're not allowed to lie, period. That's clearly easier to parse, and there's no slippery slopes. But Jewish law is making the claim that that system just doesn't work. There are certainly going to be cases in which you have to commit a transgression for a noble end. But the minute you allow that, indeed, it gets really messy, and it's really dangerous. By the way, let's just point out that self-defense, right? Self-defense is a classic example of the ends justify the means. Who says that I can kill to save my life? Killing is wrong, isn't it? Isn't murder murder? No, but we assume that I'm allowed to murder to save my own life, because sometimes at least, the ends justify the means. The minute you open that door, that Pandora's box, life gets really, really complicated.
It's also contradictory to the absolutes, which is the Ten Commandments and all the laws. It strictly says no. Don't. I guess to make life easy, you're right. We open up life, reality, and then it opens up to interpretations, and everything gets interpreted. And I guess that's how everything is derived, because there is no. He cannot leave in an absolute. You know, lo tirtzach. Period. It didn't say you can.
There are those who say it says lo tirtzach and not lo laharog. It says don't murder and don't kill, right, which might open up. But anyway, just let me take 30 seconds to tell you I just saw lightning. And there's a bracha for lightning. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech olam oseh maaseh bereishit. Thanking God who does the work of creation. Anyway, wow.
But can I just say one thing? What I'm worried about is, let's say precisely the case that happened this week. They arrested a jihadist in New York who was going to, now, in his fervored mind, he was doing a great good for Islam, for all sorts of things. So if we let this thing of intention on one individual, we're opening it up to every nutcase, everybody, you know what I'm saying? And, you know,
absolutely.
In those terms.
Absolutely.
And I don't think we're, you know, in the long run accomplishing.
But what's
even
the alternative?
Though there are exceptions with people that you can say, well, we're going to let them off because of, you know, even within murder trials and all this, there are exceptions and all this. But you're still not letting them on their own just say, commit, you know, you're still judging them and seeing. But if we just open it up to intentions, we're letting all these nutcases loose for all sorts of things, I think.
So, of course, you're right. There's going to have to be safeguards. There's going to have to be a framework. It's going to have to be very, very rigorous. But the alternative, we're claiming, is worse. An absolute morality that says you can never, ever lie, never, ever kill someone, no self-defense, no telling your wife her dress is beautiful. Jewish law has struggled with this. And it's come to the conclusion that there's no black and white. And we're about to see right now some of the safeguards that the rabbis put in place.
We have the, I guess we could learn from the case of Hanukkah. I mean, the Maccabees, at one point, they didn't want to fight on
Shabbat. Oh, that's very nice. Very good point.
That, I think that actually became...
That's very nice. It says in the book of Maccabees that at the beginning of the war against the Greeks, the Maccabees, when they were attacked on Shabbat, did not resist and let themselves be killed. Because you're not allowed to violate Shabbat. And killing is forbidden on Shabbat. And many other things are also forbidden on Shabbat until they came to the conclusion that they'll lose the war if they continue in this fashion. Then the principle became, violate one Shabbat in order to keep many future Shabbatot.
I think maybe they derived it to Pikuach Nefesh Doche Shabbat. Probably could
okay, right. And also this matter of Pikuach Nefesh Doche Shabbat, meaning that the saving of human life puts aside the Shabbat, is the exact same principle. Shabbat is a mitzvah to keep, but not always. Then it's a weighing of values. So let's see what this source says about it. It brings a verse.
Which page are we on now?
We're on the same page were, which is this one. Mm-hmm. It brings a verse from the book of Judges that says, blessed above women shall Yael be, the wife of Hever the Kenite. Above women in the tent shall she be blessed. Period. Now this is the story of the battle of the Israelites against Sisera, the Canaanite king. And the Canaanite forces were vanquished, and Sisera fled, and he fled to the tent of Yael, who was of the tribe of the Canaanites. And according to the verses, what she did is, he fell asleep, and she took a tent peg and put it through his forehead. That's what the verses of the book of Judges say. But according to the rabbi, she did something else. Let's read on. Rabbi Yochanan said that wicked, wretched Sisera had sevenfold intercourse with Yael at that time. As it says, at her feet he sunk, he fell, he lay, etc. And they read that to say that seven times. So there's a lot missing from the story. What the rabbis are assuming is, based on Agadah, that how did she get him to fall asleep and how did she kill him? Because she seduced him. She seduced this enemy general as he was fleeing from the battlefield. And then he fell asleep, and then she took the tent peg and rammed it through his forehead. In other words, she committed a sin of adultery. She was married for the greater good of killing this general and saving the Jewish people so he'll never live again to muster an army against the Israelite tribes. Ah, that is another case of adultery, of an avira, a sin, a transgression, L'shem Shemaim, for the good of heaven. The means justifying the ends justifying the means. And then, the most important line. but she derived pleasure from his intercourse? Rabbi Yochanan said, all the favors of the wicked are evil to the righteous. Bring a verse to prove it. So what just happened? There seems to be an assumption in this text that yes, you're allowed sometimes in certain cases to suppose that the ends justify the means, and you're allowed to commit the most heinous sins in certain cases for the greater good, but there's one condition, that you get no pleasure out of it. That it hurts you to do it. You don't really want to do it. It's against you. It's only for that end, and not for your own personal aggrandizement or pleasure or advancement. And the Gemara says, but sexual intercourse, there's always going to be pleasure. So even though her goals, her purposes, the ends were holy, but if there was pleasure involved, it's never allowed. And the conclusion is, she didn't get any pleasure out of it, because the favors of the wicked are evil to the righteous. Fine. But here we have a principle, and it's a really, really deep and exquisitely thought out idea, that when you're weighing and struggling, should I not? Should I transgress? Should I do this terrible thing? Should I commit this crime, this sin for the greater good? You have to ask yourself, why am I doing it? For the greater good? Or because someplace inside, I really want to do it. I get some little iota of pleasure out of it. And if any pleasure involved, any self-gain, it's no good.
I think it
that's as limiting
probably explain it as there was no pleasure in it. She was a kinni. Sisrael was a Midianite. So these are enemies. Actually, the Kini was a relative of I think, somewhere that there were relatives of the tribes of Israel.
I don't remember that Sisrael was a Midianite.
Yeah, Sisrael was a Midianite.
It could be. I don't remember it.
No?
But you know what? That's really a detail that's not going to take us to the principles here.
Well, just to take the pleasure out of it, because that will make it a sin.
Fine. But I want us to think about the principle here. Think about the principle.
Okay.
But isn't that, aren't you just taking the premise and moving it? It's still an absolute. If there's a teeniest, tiniest bit of pleasure, how do you measure that?
You're right. It's hard.
I love hearing that.
It's hard.
I mean,
but still, I feel that there's a principle here that could be put to good use. Because when I'm weighing this issue, I'll give you a very good example. It's forbidden to speak Lashon Hara. It's forbidden to speak libel about someone. But there's someone in your department at work that you're just certain is doing the wrong thing, and you have to report him or her. And you're about to go to the supervisor and report the terrible things this person is doing. It's Lashon Hara, but you're allowed to speak Lashon Hara for a toelet, for a positive purpose. But then you ask yourself, wait a second, am I doing this for the greater good? Or am I really doing it because I have a grudge against this person? You have to ask yourself. Now, the answer might not be simple or straightforward, but that's the question to ask. And if you remember, that person did do something to me a year ago that I always wanted to get back at them, or I had something simmering my heart against them, then you ask yourself, perhaps I'm reporting them for that reason, not for the greater good. That is a sign that you're about to go off a slippery slope and it's time to pull back.
But what if doing it is going to serve the greater good more than the pleasure that the person... I mean, it's just...
How did you know that I've been thinking about that for the past few hours? That's a very hard question.
Yeah, really. Whenever you get into blacks and whites... And absolutes,
well, what about the pleasure of... that you're a good spy and you've deceived this guy and you're pretty happy the way you pulled this off. Is that different than the sexual pleasure in terms of now you're within your competence and you're pretty happy about the move you pulled? Is that on the same scale? Okay.
So is the difference that it happened, that the pleasure wasn't during, but the pleasure was later?
Delayed gratification there.
I don't know if that makes a difference. So let's see more sources and see if these sources help us with some of the questions, the issues that have come up here. This next source is wonderful, fascinating, instructive. We're reading from a rabbi, Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. We're talking about the middle and end of the 19th century in Volozhin, in Eastern Europe. His acronym of Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin is Netziv. He's called the Netziv. And he wrote a wonderful commentary on the Torah called Hemek Davar. And he wrote a commentary on his own commentary. It's like footnotes on his own commentary called Harchev Davar. And in the Harchev Davar, on our Parsha, he brings the Gemara we just read from Tractate Nazir about Yael and about Sisra and about the intercourse and about the pleasure. He brings it and he applies it to Yaakov and Esav. One must know that every evil character trait in the world is part of God's creation. And therefore, all of them contain a certain aspect of good. It's a place sometimes for stealing and deception and killing. All of these things have a place at the right time. This is clearly not absolute ethics, right? This is situational. Behold, this is similar to poisonous drugs. This is written in about 1870, before chemotherapy. Behold, this is similar to poisonous drugs that may sometimes have medicinal uses for certain illnesses. However, when they are used to promote healing, the doctor must exercise great care and must use them sparingly, lest he err and endanger the patient. That's so powerful a metaphor, right? You might say, as a doctor, I will never use chemotherapy because it's poison. But there's a place to use poison in healing in a very, very limited and circumscribed fashion. So it is with all the evil character traits. They are good under certain circumstances. However, one must be sure to employ them only under the guidance of an expert authority and only sparingly in order not to go further than is necessary. Certainly, when you have an idea or a thought that you might have to do an avirah lishma, a transgression for a noble reason, you don't do it alone. You take advice, you ask, you think about it deeply. You need an expert authority. Now behold, the time arrived for Yaakov to employ the trait of deception and cunning. And indeed, in his case, it was permitted as a transgression for a noble purpose. Using the language of that passage from Tractate Nazir that we saw. Avera lishma. However, in Midrash Rabbah, now he's bringing another source we saw. It is said that Yaakov was punished for causing Esav to cry with a great and bitter cry. And this is ultimately what brought about the bitter cry of Mordechai. So we have to put all these things together now. Says the Netziv that what Yaakov did was right. On the other hand, the Midrash says that we, his descendants, were punished for it with the events of Purim. How do you put those two things together? So he says, this is seemingly difficult. Why was he punished for Esav's crime more than for the terrible consternation that he caused the saintly father? Why specifically for Esav was he punished, making Esav feel bad? Rather, the matter is that in the employment of a transgression for noble purpose, one must be exceedingly careful not to derive any personal pleasure or benefit from it at all. Personal pleasure or benefit that one derives makes it a forbidden transgression, as explained in Tractate Yevamot and in Tractate Nazir, same place we just saw. In this case, Yaakov derived no personal benefit or pleasure from the great consternation that he caused his father. Rather, he was certainly quite pained by it, but he had no choice. Such was not the case concerning the cry of Esav. He rejoiced in his heart and was therefore punished. For he derived pleasure as a result of his deception, and that is forbidden. Now, how do we know he got pleasure? We don't. But he was a human being, and he was at odds with his brother all the time, he must have gotten some pleasure from it, and that makes it so bad and forbidden that he was punished for it. And here we really get to your question. He was punished for it. It was wrong. That means he shouldn't have done it. What would have happened to the Jewish people?
So if you do something under duress, that's a mitigating factor.
Yeah, that's a whole different kind of kosher worms.
So in this case, whose idea was it to deceive?
You're right. It was his mother's idea. But he went along with it.
Well, maybe he felt...
He had to honor his mother,
of course,
she said. Yeah.
Maybe he felt coerced, right. But we have a principle...
No, he was punished not for the deed, but because of the pleasure he felt.
Well, let's go into it deeper. Let's ask that question right now. Let's ask Charles's question. He was punished not for the deed, but for the pleasure, says Charles, as a rhetorical question.
Well, I think that's what this says, no?
Okay, so let's ask the following question now. Why is it that attaining pleasure disqualifies the deed? Why?
Because that's a personal... Your reason for doing the bad deed was for the greater good, the collective greater good. But the pleasure derived is personal. You're driving personal pleasure.
And therefore, why does this disqualify? Think it through logically.
I think there's a good analogy there with war. When you go to war, it's a terrible deed that you do because you have to kill. But I think you're not supposed to take, you know, many times, you know, in the war, said you're not to take any...
spoils.
Yeah, booty.
Mm-hmm. Booty.
Spoil.
It was a forbidden thing. Actually, Saul lost his kingship, you might call it, you know, because of that.
The booty they took.
But that's because you derive pleasure out of that. You went as a necessity to the war.
Okay,
to
good.
An act that
good.
Save your
but it doesn't answer the question yet. It's a nice example, right? It doesn't answer the question. Right, so let's just.
Justifying the fact that pleasure is.
Yeah, but again, why? Why? Psychologically, why? Yeah. I think we almost said this a few minutes ago. Right?
In spite of the group outcome, you're still responsible for yourself.
You're responsible for yourself.
So, even, it goes back to the very beginning, and we're talking about doing it out of good intention, a bad thing out of good intention or vice versa, you still have the personal responsibility regardless of the outcome. And so if you're doing it, you may have a good outcome and benefit from that, but you can't erase that slippery slope in and of itself of doing things with good intention. And the bad...
I must admit, I didn't completely follow.
It goes back to the personal versus the group, regardless of the outcome, basically.
So, I think I know what you're saying, but I might be guilty of putting words in your mouth. So,
I don't agree with the word pleasure, but regardless of that, pleasure sort of compromises the good intention, because you have the good intention as one goal, but then if you have pleasure as another goal, then are you really doing it for good intention? So then it
right.
calls into
right.
question your
right.
whole motivation.
Yeah.
So I understand the reasoning process.
And that might be what
which is what I think you were...
Yes.
It struck
yeah.
me
yeah.
that's what
yeah.
you were saying.
Yeah.
It's calling for a depth of character to be exercised at all times.
But all I will say is I would struggle for a different word than pleasure, because when you look at a king or the ascent of power, we know all these people have a certain personal narcissism. And there's never anybody who doesn't have that. And therefore, you may gain power to exercise it for good, but you're also enjoying the power unto itself.
Yeah, yeah.
And you would be disqualifying... I mean, everything relation has this struggle
yeah.
for power and all these
yeah,
issues.
Yeah, it comes up with something you said earlier. Yeah. difficult questions, but I do want to just make sure everyone understood what was being said here, that the ultimate justification of this sin, this transgression, this crime, is not the positive consequences, but the intention of positive consequences. And being that it's the doing it for the intention, for the good intention, well, it's hard to know my own intentions. And you have to be certain you're doing it for a good intention. So if there's any pleasure benefit, if there's any personal benefit, then you can't be certain that you're really doing it for the right reason. And therefore, it's better to refrain. Because it's such a dangerous thing, because it's a slippery slope, perhaps we should let someone else do it, but not me. Because it's dangerous for me to do it, because I'm not sure that my intentions are pure.
Because if there's any doubt, you have to live with that the rest of your life.
You have to live with it the rest
if
of your
you,
life?
If you can.
And it's a personal slippery slope. You don't want to open the floodgate within your own soul to do it again. So you always have to be certain you're doing it for the right reason. It's kind of a, it's a safeguard, because we know this is such a dangerous thing.
Which would explain why it may have been a prophecy and a lesson, or a deterrent.
I'm not sure I understand.
Well, if it was God's direction that that deceit occur...
No, it wasn't. It was.
He didn't.
He didn't, well, right. He didn't say deceive. God just said what's supposed to be. He didn't say to do anything to accomplish it. That's the question here. Should I do anything or not to accomplish it?
Nothing. Just, it's a prophecy and it'll happen anyway. It's a prophecy.
Yeah.
They just helped it go along.
I think the, if the intention changes, because the intention is not the original intention, it's like the example I've given about if you take a booty. It's like you went there to rob. You didn't go for the maybe the general understands that, understands the pure reason. But then those who are also human beings and those who are actually involved in the process of killing, for them it's already warped, because now I'm involved with robbing, with taking. So the intention itself is not the original intention. And right there you make it a greater sin, or a graver sin.
But under what you just said, Natalie, if you're a war and you're a soldier, and then you take booty, the sin wasn't the war. The sin was the booty.
I had the same experience. I'm not going to go into details, but we were in a situation where people were actually taken in. To us, you know, is frontline, you know, infantry guys, we didn't like what the jobniks, did. Those who could drive and go back home. We were stuck, on the ground doing what we were doing. But those who had, if it was a mechanic or a driver, well, not to generalize, but some, driving out with booty.
Yeah.
In my mind, as a young person, kind of warped things, Here you are doing it from certain...
Yeah, I understand, I understand.
So I think that as a young person, I was mixed up. So what is the purpose of this? That we came here for a reason, and then you see people actually driving with things.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm trying. Yeah. The intention changes, and that itself is the same right there.
Would anyone else like to add or question as we come to a close?
Why would a prophecy be communicated if there's no intent to have an effect?
That's a good question. It could be there's an intent to have an effect, but not necessarily an intent to have an effect through forbidden means. It could be an intent to have an effect to educate the child properly, to groom him for leadership, but that doesn't mean to use deceit and thievery to do so. Right? That's another step. Yeah.
Is there any commentary on, this is a little different, that the prophecy was communicated to the woman and hence the will or the vision of the woman became, in sort of a male-oriented system here, it was the vision and the prophecy through the woman that won out in terms of the line of the Jewish people. Because Isaac's vision would have been Esau, and that got changed by the wife. So that's sort of a major step in terms of male-female relations, if you ask me.
That's a true point. That's a true point here. The prophecy was to her, and that vision went out over Isaac's understanding. Yeah. So I just want.
If she had communicated that to him and they had discussed it, they could have come to an agreement that Jacob was the better one to get the Abraham.
Right. It's a whole other question, a whole other shiur, a whole other class. Why she didn't talk with her husband about it? I talked about another context. So I just wanted to sum up. We didn't get to see all the sources. In other sources, would have seen the following: that there have to be two basic questions or two basic tests that one undergoes before doing a transgression for a noble purpose. The first one, which is we didn't talk about, perhaps it's obvious, it's in sources we didn't get to, that there has to be a weighing, there has to be a taking counsel with others who are wiser, to be certain that the benefit is greater than the loss, than the pain, than the damage done. And after that has been ascertained, there secondly has to be certainty, as much as possible, that there's no personal motivation involved, there's no benefit, there's no pleasure. And if those two litmus tests, benchmarks, are met, it might just be that there could be what's called an avira lishma, a transgression for a noble purpose in which the ends justify the means. Okay. Good evening.
Thank you. Okay. Happy Thanksgiving, all.
Happy Thanksgiving.